Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, white supremacy and American Christianity. Scholar, commentator, and author Robert P. Jones was raised in a Southern Baptist family in Mississippi. He holds a PhD in religion, but in a new book, he explains how his church and other white Christian denominations became and continue to be powerful cultural forces for white supremacy. This includes evangelicals in the South, Protestants in the Midwest, and Catholics in the Northeast. Robert P. Jones is the author of White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. He's also the founder and CEO at the Public Religion Research Institute. I spoke with him Monday morning. Robert, all over the country, we're seeing the tearing down of statues, the removing of flags, and other racist symbols of the past. But you write in your new book about the lack of scrutiny given to white Christian churches. Talk about that, please.
Well, thanks. I'm glad to be with you today. So I titled the book White Too Long, which is a provocative title, but it is a way, I think, of thinking about and challenging, I think, white Christians to think about the impact that whiteness has really had on Christianity. And I do think this is something that has largely escaped scrutiny. So if we go back, for example, to those monuments in Richmond, Virginia, the former Confederate capital of the Confederacy, one of the main monuments to Jefferson Davis there was set up and largely coordinated in concert with the white Christian churches in Richmond. Over 200,000 people showed up, you know, for the installation of the Jefferson Davis monument in 1907. And they actually took a break along 3 days of celebrations on Sunday morning so that all the people participating could go and attend the white Christian churches all over Richmond as kind of part of the celebration of, you know, this honoring and really in many ways making a kind of saint, a kind of Confederate saint out of Jefferson Davis.
But you're not just talking about evangelical Protestants in the South. You're also talking about mainline Protestants in the Midwest and white Catholics in the Northeast.
That's right. And that's actually crucial, you know, for understanding, I think, where we are today in the country. One of the, I think, surprising things that I found is how much this legacy of this kind of intertwinement of white supremacy and Christianity, and again, not just among Christians in the South, which are heavily evangelical, but among those mainline Protestant groups such as Lutherans and Episcopalians and Presbyterians that are more dominant in the upper Midwest, and white Catholics that are more dominant in urban centers, you know, in the Northeast. And what's remarkable about it is that you can actually still see the legacy, I think, of this history in all three of these white Christian subgroups. And so, for example, if we ask a question about something right out of the headlines today about the treatment of African-Americans by police, we had a question at PRRI that we've asked about whether you see the killing of African-American men by police as part of a pattern of how police treat African-Americans, or are these just isolated incidents? And it turns out that white Christians across the board, not just evangelicals, but mainline and white Catholics, are nearly twice as likely as whites who are not Christian to see these things as isolated incidents. In other words, they have very tough time connecting the dots and seeing things like structural racism in the country.
But I find myself wondering whether you, in looking at these religious breakdowns, found political breakdowns as well. In other words, did you see differences within those mainline religious groups as Republican or Democrat, or did you see any political differences there?
So this is a really great and key question because, you know, one of the things I'm arguing in the book, or the central argument in the book, is that it is white Christian identity that is doing the work here, and not just partisanship, not just where you live, those kinds of things. So this is a really key question. So, you know, what I did in the book is employed some more sophisticated statistical techniques to see if being Republican, for example, was really what this was about, right? Because white Christians do, for example, tend to be more identified with Republican, tend to vote for Republican presidential candidates. So maybe it's all about partisanship. But remarkably, when I put this relationship between kind of holding these more racist attitudes and white Christian identity into a model where I controlled for a whole range of things that I could think of that might be alternative explanations. So partisanship, region, gender, education level, all kinds of things. Even when I put in a model that controlled for those alternative explanations, this relationship between holding more racist attitudes and white Christian identity continued to stand up. And so, in other words, it wasn't explainable just by partisan identity or regional identity. It was, you know, at the end of the day, you can say it was an independent and predictive relationship between holding racist attitudes and identifying as a white Christian in the country.
So in other words, feeling as though whites within those groups want to remain supreme.
Yeah, I like how you're unpacking this, because I think too often when many whites hear the word white supremacy, they immediately sort of turn off, right? They think of, you know, people dressed in sheets and hoods, and so they think of the KKK or extremist groups. But what I'm talking about in the book, and really what we're still wrestling with in the country today, is much broader. It's in many ways much more common and at the same time much more insidious than that. And that is exactly what you said. If you just flip the words around and you, instead of saying white supremacy, you say the supremacy of whites, this idea, right, that society should be organized, it really is about how society is organized and whose lives are valued over others. And for most of American history, right, we have had a society that has been very deliberately and by design set up to value the lives of whites over the lives of non-whites and to privilege those lives, give them more opportunities, help them live in better neighborhoods, go to better schools, get better jobs. Like these are structural effects that have been put into place over generations in the country. And this is what I'm really talking about when I use the word white supremacy in the book.
You write that even though white denominations have taken pains to distance themselves from slavery per se, still the legacy remains and white Christians stand out in their attitudes.
You know, that's right. I should say that it is important that most denominations have made efforts. The Catholic bishops have made efforts. The National Council of Churches have made efforts. The Southern Baptist Convention has made efforts to apologize for slavery. But I think the deeper problem, slavery was sort of one of, or really the cruelest expression of white supremacy. But white supremacy is much bigger than just slavery. And for example, one of the things I discovered in doing some historical research is how dismayed African-American abolitionists like Frederick Douglass were at the end of the Civil War at how quickly whites mended the fences, North and South. And to his dismay, it was that, yes, the Civil War settled the issue of slavery, but it very much left the issue of white supremacy in place. And in fact, that mending of the fences, one of the ways that happened so quickly is because whites in the North and the South actually agreed on the subject of white supremacy. And maybe one example, the most dramatic, is Charles Finney, who was an abolitionist, white Presbyterian minister in New York, right? So Northern abolitionist. And at the end of the Civil War, one of his younger proteges was talking to him about arranging for allowing African-Americans to come and participate in worship services. And he stopped him in his tracks and said, oh, no, you misunderstand. The question of abolition is a separate question from the issue of amalgamation, was the term that he used. And that abolition was clearly something wrong, but segregation, not so much.
Are you talking about what was or what is?
Yeah. You know, I'm from Mississippi, and one of my favorite quotes from William Faulkner is, I'm going to paraphrase it here, but he basically says that the past is never dead, it's not even past, is the quote from William Faulkner. And I think that that's true for us today, is that this historical legacy, you know, was built into our theology, our institutions, our laws, And so those get handed down generation over generation. So even as individual opinions may change and may not look like they did a generation ago, we're still inheriting a whole range of teachings, institutional arrangements that were built with this assumption of white supremacy at its core. And so I think deconstructing that and really interrogating that is work that's really barely begun.
What about white people who think of themselves as people who hold good and warm feelings about Black people, but you're saying nevertheless that somehow they continue to associate with white Christianity, which has inherent this feeling of white supremacy?
It is one of the, I think, more perplexing things to see in the data. So at the same time, we see when we ask people, for example, how warmly do you feel toward African Americans, right? That's a fairly straightforward question.
Right.
We get across the board people saying very warm, right? And so to take white evangelicals, the group in which I grew up, for example, that group is the most likely to say, out of other white Christian groups, the most likely to say that they hold warm feelings toward African Americans. But when we measure their views across these 15 questions that I use in the book and what I call the racism index, so 15 different questions on attitudes about race and structural racism, they also score the highest on that index. So simultaneously saying, I feel the most warmly toward African Americans, and at the same time scoring fairly high on this racism index. And I think that's the dilemma we're in, right? Is that many white Christians are so inside of a world that they've inherited that they just don't see it. And one of the things that I hope the book will do is actually start some more critical conversations where we get beyond, well, do I feel personal prejudice toward someone who's African-American? And more about, how do I understand my own history? How do I understand the history of my own church? And how do I understand my place in that and its role in perpetuating and even legitimizing the kinds of inequalities that we see all around us today?
Robert, tell us how you grew up.
Well, I grew up in Texas, but mostly in Mississippi. I grew up Southern Baptist, and I was that kid. I went to church 5 times a week. I mean, I was, 5 or 6 hours a week I was in church. So I was very steeped in this. I went to a Southern Baptist college. I have a degree from a Southern Baptist seminary. So I've drunk very deeply at this well and living in the Deep South. And my ancestors on both sides of my family actually go back 6 generations in Middle Georgia and around Macon, Georgia, Bibb County, Twiggs County, Georgia, and pretty much Baptist all the way back.
How did you feel about Blacks at that time during your growing up, during your education?
Yeah. Well, I have to say two things. One, I owe a great debt to my parents who grew up in Jim Crow, Macon, Georgia, and very much absorbed that culture, but took great pains, I think, to put some distance between it and me and my siblings. So I think they really made some decisions to kind of break the chain so that just all of those assumptions coming through using the N-word and thinking very disparagingly about African-Americans, the kinds of racialized jokes that tend to come through, they really put a halt to that for my siblings and I. But at the same time, I cannot say, so I grew up in the 70s and 80s. Those are the decades I grew up in Jackson, Mississippi. And having been at church all that time, and of course the 70s in particular, were still times when civil rights were getting worked out. I remember, for example, it was until the mid 70s that our public schools actually were integrated. That I remember 20 years after Brown v. Board of Education,
exactly,
right? You know, that the first African-American students actually showed up at our school. And so this was very much a reality around us. And yet I can say I never once heard a sermon or a Sunday school lesson or a Bible or participated in a Bible study that really talked about civil rights, African-Americans and inequality, our own denomination's role in slavery, in perpetuating and legitimizing slavery. There was utter silence on that front. And even as civil rights were getting worked out all around us, I think that's the thing, the deafening silence on this issue is the thing, when I reflect back on it now, that really seems the most prominent feature of that religious experience to me.
During the worst part, the civil rights demonstrations, and even earlier, weren't some white churches trying to play a role in helping that movement forward. Are you distinguishing between them and other churches who played no role whatsoever?
Yeah, you know, it's important to note, I mean, there were courageous leaders on the ground, white Christian leaders on the ground. The National Council of Churches took a number of stands during the Civil Rights Movement. And even, I mean, remarkably, even the Southern Baptist Convention, when Brown v. Board of Education was passed, the actual official position from the Southern Baptist Convention was approval. But the great disconnect, I think, between those leaders that were standing out there, and even the churches that were organizing, and denominational resources that were getting built, there was a great disconnect between these leaders and these churches, these exceptional churches on the one hand, and the great masses of people in the pews on the other. And what we really see is that despite these courageous examples that are worth celebrating and worth noting, it wasn't enough to diffuse all the way down into the pews and to be the default position of the vast majority of white Christians. And again, I'm not just talking about the South. I'm talking about the Northeast and the Midwest as well. It wasn't enough to really seep down and to be the default position. It didn't move the needle for the vast majority of people in the pews. And you know, the proof in the pudding is really where public opinion is today, right? That if we had really seen something shift and move, the public opinion on issues of race and racism would look very different than they do today.
It's interesting when you talk about various parts of the country, you leave out the far West. How come?
It's interesting that the patterns are actually clearer in the Midwest, the Northeast, and the South. And what's notable about the West, actually, is that the biggest quote-unquote religious group in the West are religiously unaffiliated Americans. So in some ways, the story is the same, but what you have is that it gets muted in the West, in the upper Midwest in particular, because whites who are unaffiliated are actually the majority. So the attitudinal patterns don't show up in the same way because the sheer numbers of white Christians aren't there in the way they are in the other parts of the country.
But how do the attitudes of the unaffiliated compare with those who are church-going members?
Yeah, this is the thing I think that we see over and over and over, survey after survey, question after question, this gap between whites who are not affiliated with any religion and white Christians of any kind, mainline Protestant or Catholic. That was the thing I think that I was, you know, even as someone who spends his day job looking at these kinds of public opinion numbers all the time, when I really started looking systematically at these questions around, you know, things like Confederate symbols, treatment of African Americans in the criminal justice system, you know, all the way through, this gap was so consistent. And we're talking like 20, 30 percentage point gaps between white Christians on the one hand and white unaffiliated Americans on the other. And, you know, I think the key here really is that the way that white Christian theology has developed out of this historical context that we've been discussing does mean that it is really the theology, the practices have in many ways created a blind spot for white Christians for being able to even see issues of structural racism and systemic racism in the country. And the key to that, I think, really is this kind of hyper-individualist theology, where all of religion gets boiled down to being about a personal relationship between an individual and Jesus. And it really is about personal piety that is the measure of what authentic religion is about. And what that means is that you can cultivate this kind of interiorized version of religion that is completely and hermetically sealed off from all kinds of questions of racial justice outside your own purview or outside the walls of the church. One of the most, I think, compelling things that has rung in my ears as I've been writing is Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail, where he looks at all these white Christian churches who are doing nothing on civil rights issues, and he talks about them sitting behind the anesthetizing stained glass windows, right? That the stained glass windows are actually dulling their consciences instead of sharpening them. And I think that has been the effect, that the way that the bulk of white Christian theology has developed, it really has just narrowed the moral vision of white Christians so that they can simultaneously be in good relationship with Jesus and indifferent, silent, or even opposing civil rights for African Americans.
And of course, the image of Jesus for most white Christians is one of a light-skinned man.
Yeah. I mean, the one hanging on the wall of many, you know, white Christian churches, not just here, but around the world, is actually one that was developed in the early part of the 20th century. And it was developed for a Swedish youth magazine. So it's a Scandinavian, it literally is a Scandinavian depiction of Jesus. So he's light hair, blue eyes, light skin. And that portrait has been produced tens of millions of times. It was actually mass produced before World War II, and soldiers carried it off to war in their pockets. So it became kind of the default image of Jesus. And, you know, if Jesus is white, it really does, I think, also shape how you think about salvation and who you think Jesus is concerned about.
More of my conversation with Robert P. Jones when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here is the rest of my conversation with Robert P. Jones. His new book is titled White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. Robert, you talk about the 13 questions you designed in your book. Talk about how it is possible to measure racism.
Yeah, well, this is one of the, you know, thorniest issues I had to tackle in the book. You can't exactly get in touch with respondents in a public opinion survey and said, you know, excuse me, ma'am, glad to talk to you today. Do you think you're racist or not? You know what you're going to get, but it's not going to be that helpful.
Right.
To that approach. So what you want to do when you're asking really about anything sensitive in a public opinion survey is two things. One, this survey was conducted online and not in person, so there's not a human interviewer, because what we often see is people will hedge their answers when they're talking to another human being because they don't want to sound racist or bigoted, so they'll hedge. And so this was online, and so people took it online in their privacy, you know, in their own private setting.
How many people?
So this is a survey of 2,500 Americans, so it's a fairly large survey. That's about 2.5 times your typical political survey. It's a random probability sample of all Americans, bilingual surveys. It's really top shelf, gold standard methodology. And then to make sure that people weren't reacting to just one, I mean, you know, attitudes about race, racism, white supremacy, they're multifaceted. So you can't just ask about one thing. So that's why we tried to cover in the survey. And again, the kind of four main areas are attitudes around Confederate symbols, perceptions about African-American economic mobility, upward mobility or lack of upward mobility, the treatment of African-Americans in the criminal justice system and by police, and then some general perceptions of racial discrimination.
Give me an example of how you pose the questions.
So, you know, I named one before. We've asked about monuments and flags, but for example, do you see monuments to Confederate soldiers as more symbols of Southern pride or symbols of racism? Another question that's an agree or disagree question: generations of slavery and discrimination have created conditions that make it difficult for Blacks to work their way out of the lower class. Do you agree or disagree? Do you think recent killings of African-American men by police are isolated incidents? Are they part of a broader pattern of how police treat African-Americans? And then one on racial resentment, for example, today, discrimination against whites has become as big a problem as discrimination against Blacks and other minorities. So there's 15 questions, but that's a pretty good set of example of how. So we wanted to make sure that what we were measuring is not just someone's response to one particular question, but to get a composite portrait of their attitudes here. It turns out these questions actually, is in statistical terms, scale together very well, which means that they are in many ways measuring similar underlying attitudes. So we did do some checks to make sure that one of these questions wasn't, for example, kind of an outlier in aggregate, but they all basically hold together and are measuring a set of underlying attitudes. So we're kind of indirectly getting to people's composite attitudes around racism.
And what you're saying this survey showed to you is that someone who regularly attends a white evangelical church or other Protestant church is more likely to oppose equality for Blacks than a person who attends less often or a person with no religious affiliation.
That's right. And we checked two things. We checked to see how much of this was about identity, white Christian identity, right? So, and there we tested the differences between white Christian, people who identified as white Christian, and whites who identified with no religion, again, to kind of check that difference. But then we also checked, that's an identity measure, but I also wanted to check behavior measures. And what you're pointing to is behavior, right? And because one objection to seeing this kind of correlation that we often hear is someone saying, well, these are just people who are Christian in name only, right? So they identify as Christian, but they haven't really been formed by the tradition. They don't really go to church. They just claim the label. So I really wanted to test that as well. And it turns out that, again, even in a model that is holding, that is controlling for things like partisanship and other kinds of attributes, that I found no evidence that attending church makes Christian white Christians less racist. Like, that's usually the thing. Well, if they attend church, they'll be less racist. I found no evidence for that among white Catholics or white mainline Protestants. And when I looked among white evangelicals, it turns out that the opposite is true. That is, the strength of the relationship between holding racist attitudes and identifying as a white evangelical Protestant is actually stronger among those who attend more frequently than among those who attend less frequently.
And yet, if you ask them personally, straight out, do you consider yourself a racist? You believe that the answer would be no.
That's right. And I think that's the dilemma we find ourselves in. And in fact, when I was interviewing some folks who are kind of doing some of this work in a white Christian church in Macon, Georgia, they said that one of the biggest things they had to overcome was really their own sense of themselves, a kind of innocence narrative that they had, that, look, we're good people who do good things. I mean, I think that's the way that many white Christian churchgoers think of themselves. And, you know, of course, there is a lot of truth to that. There's charity work, there's helping homeless people, there's helping people in poverty, helping people who are recently out of prison. There's a lot of those kinds of ministries that are very real and doing very good work. And at the same time, there is this legacy, there is this history, and there is this real blind spot among white Christians that that the history explains, that we can see in the data, and again, that white Christians are still figuring out, I think, how to even see, much less address.
How do you identify or define white supremacy or the attitude of white supremacy?
I think it's important just to keep it as simple as possible. And I think it really is a question, again, not of only of personal attitude, but what kinds of policies one supports, what kinds of social arrangements one supports, because it really is a question of community. And how have we set up our communities? So when I think of white supremacy, I think of it as, do we have a society set up where, and do I support a society that's set up to value the lives of everyone equally, right? Where African-Americans have equal chances to others. And even the current pandemic, I think, has exposed the inequalities in our current society and the structural ways in which Black people and Brown people are more at risk, right? The infection rates among African-Americans and Latinos are nearly double the rates of white Americans in the country. And it's largely because they work in service-related jobs, where they are having to choose between, they're not in white collar jobs where they can sit behind a computer and do all their work on Zoom. I mean, they're working construction, they're working in restaurants, they're working in grocery stores, all places where one has to put one's health at risk in order just to make ends meet. But I think that's a very, very clear way, I think, that all of us, I mean, in particular, white Christians should take a clear look at it and say, well, what's going on there? How have we set up society so that something like this and these health disparities that we're seeing really put a mirror up in front of us and say, okay, we've set up a society this way that puts non-whites at risk. How did we get here and what was our role in getting us here?
Robert, take us back a little ways in history. How did white Christian churches in the South and elsewhere rationalized slavery in the many decades before the Civil War.
Yeah. It's important to remember, you know, in the colonies and in the early United States that, you know, we were a society that even in non-slave holding colonies tolerated, you know, as a whole, slavery in the country. And it wasn't just the South. I mean, New York, you know, was a big slave marketplace in the early history of the country. And so if you think about that and you think about the way church was done in these early years of the country, and this is the where beyond elite theology, but the way that kind of religion really gets built is on the ground. And so if you think about this context, one fairly common context would be that white slave owners would go to church on Sunday and they would bring enslaved people with them. And they would put them in the back of the church. White people would sit up front. Enslaved people would be put in the back or in specially constructed balconies to hold them. And you can still see in some of our older churches, built into white supremacy built into the architecture of those churches, right? And then if you ask your question, okay, what kind of Christianity could be practiced in that setting? Then the history becomes fairly clear. So you're not going to preach a lot about Exodus and liberation, right? Because that's going to get you fairly quickly into trouble with a slaveholding society and set of values. You're going to preach a lot out of the New Testament about obedience to your masters and to your superiors. And, you know, of course, there's even a whole book in the New Testament that is actually addressed to a slave. And the upshot of that book is even an escaped slave should voluntarily return to their masters and into the institution of slave and should submit themselves to the institution of slavery. So there were very straightforward ways of preaching this from the pulpit. But our hymns, our liturgies, I mean, even taking communion, for example, right? Whites took communion first, enslaved African-Americans took communion, if they were even offered it, second. And so even something that's designed to kind of talk about Christian unity was itself segregated and set up to be very hierarchical in expressions that white people were superior by divine mandate and design to African-Americans. And that was, like, as it should be, it was literally God's will for the best way to set up human society.
So, for example, how did a college like Oberlin get set up?
Yeah.
Who did that? How was it done?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. There were many colleges like that set up as abolitionist colleges, like Berea College in Kentucky, right? Set up, you know, as abolitionist colleges. Oberlin is interesting because Finney was actually involved. And we talked about Finney earlier there. So there, I think there's just this great contradiction. So at the same time, there are these abolitionist efforts being made, educational efforts being made to open education, to offer African-Americans education on equal footing as whites. And at the same time, there are these contradictions that continue. Another one that's even more recent, so Martin Luther King was invited to the National Council of Churches to speak. He was on the editorial board of the Christian Century, which is kind of the flagship magazine for the mainline Protestant group of denominations. He actually first published Letter from Birmingham Jail in the Christian Century. Like, that was the place where that got published. And yet, when his son, Martin Luther King III, applied for admission to an Episcopalian school, again, this is a school with Northern roots, his son was denied admission on the basis of race. So I think we've just been, it's shot through with these contradictions of kind of one step forward, two steps back, or just outright contradiction. Two things that are happening at the same time that actually are diametrically opposed. White supremacy active over here and white supremacy being fought over here. And I think it's that fraught history that really continues all the way through, again, that we're still, I think, haven't quite reckoned with.
So what do you think the current moment tells us with all the Black Lives Matter protests out there now?
Yeah. Well, you know, you begin talking about the monuments, you know, and things that have changed. And so I was a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, I was in Richmond and I walked that whole Monument Avenue and passed five of these massive monuments, you know, to the Confederacy. And I haven't been back, but if I walked it today, four of the five of the statues are gone. And the fifth one is slated for removal. The last one to Robert E. Lee is slated for removal. my home state of Mississippi has recently removed the Confederate battle flag from its state flag. It was the last one to have it fully incorporated. And in fact, what's notable there is that before the legislature voted, the Mississippi Baptist Convention held a press conference calling on the governor and calling on the legislature to remove the Confederate battle flag as the right and Christian thing to do. I would not have anticipated those events happening a year ago when I basically completed the book. So I think there's something quite unique and different and real happening now. This current moment is, I think, a unique moment that we've been building toward. I think Charlottesville was a turning point. Certainly the mass murder of 9 worshipers in Charleston at Mother Emanuel AME Church was a turning point. And I think that it's been building, and I think we have reached a point where the dam has cracked and we're seeing the water pour through the dam. The real question for me, though, is, yes, these symbols are very, very important. Like, you know, those statues in Richmond stood for over 100 years in Richmond, and these are important things. The question, though, is whether we're going to not only remove the symbols, but interrogate the theology and the culture that legitimized and blessed those the erection of those symbols in the first place.
When you say interrogate the culture, what do you mean?
You know, that's maybe a fancy word. I really mean just asking the right questions. You know, so for me in this book, it started with seeing the public opinion data. And really, I think Charlottesville for me personally was a real turning point and seeing, you know, white supremacists chanting like neo-Nazi slogans. They were chanting blood and soil. Jews will not replace us. I mean, this is the kind of thing that was just overtly out there, and not seeing the president strongly condemn those responses, and really not seeing a huge outcry. And we did see, you know, counter protests that are important, but I think that was a turning point, you know, for me in thinking about all of this. But for me, it really started with to try to ask the right questions with a simple act of sitting down and deciding I was going to spend a couple of weeks just journaling and asking myself as a white Christian that grew up in the South, the simple question is like, when I think back about my childhood and my early adulthood, where am I conscious of race showing up in the story? Where was it visible? Where was it invisible? And really the first response I had to that was, wow, I have trouble, you know, as a white person, I had the luxury of race being kind of invisible to me, of, you know, not being visible. But once I really started asking just a few of those questions, things came back to me fairly quickly. And I think most white Christians, just to start with telling a more honest story about our origins and things like why were our churches where they were, what kinds of things went on in the public schools. Like, for example, my public school was the Rebels. My high school, it was a public integrated high school. It was about 50-50 African-American and white. We were the Rebels. Our mascot was a Confederate colonel. Our band played Dixie when the football team scored a touchdown and a cheerleader ran up and down the field with a Confederate flag. And that was the public high school in Jackson, Mississippi, that for me, and I'm kind of appalled and maybe embarrassed to even say this, to go back to that word, that received almost no interrogation by me and my white friends in high school. And so I think unpacking that, it doesn't take that much, just cracking the window a bit, I think, begins the journey.
What role, if any, do you think President Trump plays in the current atmosphere?
You know, I would say I don't see Trump as the cause of most of this, but I do see him as an expression of all of this, and actually as an amplifier of the current dynamics that we have been living into for decades. The Southern strategy, really by the Republican Party, for example, you know, has been one that really since the mid-60s has exploited white racial grievances to win elections. And that dynamic has been very consistent. The Republican Party apologized for that in 2005. And yet it's been picked back up by President Trump as a campaign strategy here. But I think it's become more and more overt during Trump's presidency. So Charlottesville is a remark to say, well, they're very fine people on both sides in Charlottesville, refusal to condemn the white supremacists outright. And even recently, his doubling down defending the Confederate flag, even when you have, I mean, and it's quite remarkable when you think about it. We have the Mississippi Baptist Convention, Walmart, Southeastern Conference football, and NASCAR condemning the Confederate flag, and our president can't seem to get behind those. I mean, those are like, you know, bedrocks of Southern culture, and he can't seem to sort of get on board there. And so I think it's fueling it. And we're seeing in public opinion data, I mean, remarkably, again, this is a question as a public opinion researcher, I never thought I would even write this question, much less analyze it. But we asked over the last few years, do you think President Trump's behavior and actions are encouraging white supremacists or not? And the last time we asked that question in the fall, nearly 6 in 10 Americans said, yes, they think our president is encouraging white supremacists. So I do think we are seeing, you know, much more than just dog whistle politics, but really, and not just wink and nod, but it's really moved from dog whistle politics to megaphone politics with our current president. And I think it's kind of pushed it really to be something much more just wide open out there in the open for everyone to see.
Robert, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
That was Robert P. Jones. His new book is titled White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover during this very difficult time. Please do continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Don't forget to wear those masks. I'm Diane Rehm.